I'm very happy now to welcome Roberto Perez. He is a sustainability activist and permaculturalist from Havana, Cuba, and he will be giving a lecture tomorrow, Wednesday, the 28th of August at 7 o'clock, titled Learning from the Most Sustainable Place on Earth. It's at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot for giving me this opportunity.
It is our pleasure. So, to talk about agriculture in Cuba today, it's important to talk about agriculture in Cuba during the Soviet period. What was it like? What was being grown and how was it being grown?
There was a period between 1965 to 1990 where the agriculture of Cuba was not very different to the conventional agricultural systems that are very common in the planet nowadays. We have a lot of tractors and the use of pesticides and chemical fertilizers were very, very huge, which affected the capacity of the land to keep producing. But I have to say that these efforts were not addressed to produce food, but to produce commodities like sugarcane, citrus, tobacco, coffee, and things that they were commodities for selling, and with that money we imported most of the food. So in terms of food security, this type of agriculture was not very important.
So what happened when the Soviet Union fell apart?
The first thing that happened was we lost the access to the oil, to the fossil fuels. This totally paralyzed the systems of food production in the country, and of course totally hit those systems of plantation agriculture. The second thing that happened was that we lost the markets that we normally have. Our natural trading pattern was the countries of the Eastern Bloc. And in the case of our products, even our bananas and our grapefruits, rum and things like that, they will be sending important amount of food, mainly the vegetable oil, some of the meat, and dairy products, and peas and things like that. So we lost people that were selling food to us, and we lost the people that were buying our products. So the whole system collapsed.
Now, can Cuba, given its landmass and population, at least theoretically feed itself if it decided that that's what it wanted to do?
I don't have any doubt that we can produce enough to feed ourselves, and even some of the crops that grow very well in our market, in our land, can be good for export markets. The size of the arable land, which is evaluated in 6.6 millions of hectares, you multiply by 2.6 and you get the acres, and the densities of population that are very widespread will make that possible. So from the theoretical point of view and from the practical point of view, the problem or the challenge will be basically in try to improve the soil and to have an operation which will be chemical free, low emissions and low inputs and low energy, and at the same time to change a little bit on the culture to make people eat what grows well in our climate and not rice or wheat or other things that need to be imported because they don't grow well in the tropics.
So during the period after the collapse of the Soviet Union in Cuba called the special period, it was rough. I mean, there were shortages of everything, and what had really been basically a kind of nice, decent middle-class lifestyle for a lot of people just fell apart. What did they do, and how did Cuba, as a government, as a community, respond to the problems that they had in terms of food and food production?
I just can give you several examples that the intake of calories went down by half, and the main deficits in the diet were iron, vitamin B, and some lipids from the oil. That really makes people very skinny and cause some problems of anemia or neuritis, even in a population that was worldwide famous because of the health. But when you cannot eat well, you cannot be healthy. So the there were three things that, in my opinion, totally affected positively the supply of food. One is the urban agriculture. So people, after some adjustment period, they started to produce food in the cities as close as possible to their house. So the Cuban cities became like big gardens. The second big thing that happened was that the massive rural transitions in millions of acres in the Cuban countryside. That means that all of these huge state enterprises that were totally based on machinery, like heavy use of chemicals, they were converted to traditional forms of agriculture and organic chemical-free operations. And just to do that, more than half of the land that was in the hands of the government was redistributed to the people, so they became individual farmers. That was like another big thing that happens. And the third big thing, in my opinion, that happened was that the policy of reforestation of the country started to be integrated with the food production. And I explained to you that, for example, if there is like a forest or some trees that needs to be protected, those forests now, they started to have fruit trees and things that produce food, and they were part, something that in permaculture we call food forests, and in Cuba it was called integrated mixed forests. So even in the reforestation campaigns, like the useful and productive species, they started to come and be implanted, and this will really, really reinforce the production of what we call perennial systems integrated to the forest. So in the protected areas, the useful species were there. In the Cuban countryside, the different forms of production were there. And in the Cuban cities, I'm telling you that right now the production is around 7 million tons of food within the Cuban cities.
7 million tons of food produced in Cuban cities, in basically vacant lots where the soil was restored or whatever it needed to happen.
There was not even soil there. In some places were concrete or construction rubble and things like that. So people very patiently started to bring organic matter, compost, and organize the high-rise beds systems that are very, very productive all year round.
We're talking to Roberto Perez about agriculture in Cuba. Now, the new agriculture that you're talking about, food forests, forest gardens, working with nature, urban agriculture, how does this compare to the pre-industrial kind of agriculture that was done in Cuba in the old days?
The thing is that the like the traditional systems that we have, they were only practicing very little spaces of Cuba. It was more plantation agriculture. But basically, I think that we rescued the best of those traditional agricultural practices in terms of like high diversity of crops that grows well on the climate, and like the animal traction, for example, and the work with like local different spaces. What is new first is like the number of like the diversity of the crops that have been increased, the polycrops and the interplanting and the natural control of pests. This is different as well. And also that massive production of biofertilizer like compost, worm casting, bioairs, the use of mycorrhiza, the use of beneficial microorganisms, and also these polycrops that also involve green medicine plants and insect repellent plants, and some of the like the tropical crops that are now very well known for their high content in proteins like moringa or morera or noni. So I think that there is a lot of add value rather than having staples growing like cassava and taro or sweet potato and those things that like or bananas and plantains in big extensions. These systems are leaf vegetables, high market value, and polycultures with like more rotation. So more diversity, more production per square feet, people base, and more market oriented for quality nutrition.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about this is that in Cuba you have a highly educated population, and one of the goals of the communist system was to have universal literacy and education. You have a lot of scientists there. What is the role of kind of educated agricultural scientists in making Cuba's agriculture what it is today?
Yeah, you're right. Like the data of 2007 was like we have 11% of the scientists of Latin America with less than 2% of the population. Right now, there are a lot of Cubans training in other places like Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and other countries, but we really, really continue our universal and free access to education. I think the role of the science is that this science is now on the service of the food production systems and of the people. So rather than thinking how to produce more commodities or increase the yields of the monocrops, these scientists that they are working in more than 87 research centers for agriculture only, and quite a few people in agricultural universities, that what they're basically doing is increasing the resilience of the crops, increasing the availability of varieties that are locally adapted to the climate, producing biofertilizers of high value, biopesticides, and decreasing the need of machinery or plowing. And in this case also, I think that our agronomists in the 90s, they had to be recycled in the terms that they have to change the way of thinking and the approach to the agriculture. The science behind these systems is called in Latin America agroecology. So rather than treat the agricultural surface as like a plantation or commodities or something that is investment, we are treating the agricultural surface as an agro ecosystem where we want to reproduce the natural relationships that happens in a forest or in an ecosystem. I know that the diversity of an agro ecosystem has to be lower because the number of plants that we eat is less, and we need big amounts of the same plants in order to produce the what we need to for eating. But we can really, really maintain the basic functions of the ecosystems in this agricultural surface. So in that way, there will be less need to irrigate, to fertilize, to spray, and to fight against the pests. So the idea is like these systems will work as much as possible as a natural spaces, and they will rely less and less on fossil fuels energies to regulate the systems in tweaking towards the products that we want.
There's a documentary that I was watching in which you were talking about this very system, and we have this in all sorts of permaculture installations here in the United States as well, is taking your garden and having it mimic the local ecosystem. And so you're working with nature rather than against nature. And as you put it, it's like a lazy man's agriculture, because you just don't have to do as much work if you're actually working with the natural systems.
Exactly. I think that this is one of the main difference. In a country with a culture of the plantation, people tend to identify the agriculture with a heavy work, sweat, illiteracy, mud, and that. So we need to come with something which is very attractive and different. And I think that that's the add value of the permaculture in terms of food production, that first we use natural forces like gravity, like the flow of organic matter in the ecosystems in our favor. We use the behavior of the animals, so the animals become our tractors, our scratchers, our pest controllers, and at the same time, we will use the beneficial relationships with the plant so they can grow in clusters, and they are not competing, but they are also cooperating. So the idea is that we really want these production systems behave like a forest, or in the case of the perennials, of at least as a good grassland, in a way that nobody fertilizes a forest, nobody irrigates a grassland, nobody, you know, do all of these typical open systems that are based on fossil fuels. So in that way, the number of hours that we have to dedicate to this different form of agriculture is drastically reduced. So you just regulate the system, harvest, control some of the species, plant, and see a lot how the system is behaving. So you can spare a few hours to do other things, like maybe find another job or have other things to do. And so in that way, you reduce the energy that you have to put into the system, the amount of water that you have to put into the system. And you can also control and increase the production by using the edges of the ecotones of the system, creating microclimates. Even within a very little limited space, you can store your own water, you can reflect the heat, you can trap the heat in special places, and you can create microclimates when some plants that normally would never grow in your climatic zone will grow there because you help them to grow. So that will also increase the diversity of what you produce and you eat, but that will also makes your life better because this food will be delicious and it will be used with or produced with your own sweat.
Now, has the Cuban diet changed since all these agricultural changes have happened in Cuba?
I think that it has changed a lot, but we are not satisfied. And I'm going to put you an example. The intake of daily vegetables tripled. So we are around 900 grams daily of like green vegetables, which is very close to where World Health Organization recommends. We stop eating pork lard and some other saturated fats that can be very, very dangerous for the health. And we are favoring now vegetable oils that they're pressed because we eat a lot of we still eat fried things, you know, that's hard. The diet, it's carbohydrate redundant, but at least people started to learn to eat more what they have on the land and less of what needs to be imported. This is something that changed as well. And I think that also people will started to diversify the intake of proteins because people started to learn to eat rabbit meat, quails, little poultry, geese, edible guinea pigs, the Peruvian style. So rather than rely like in the typical factory farm meats, people started to have a small animal husbandry on their patios. So this helped them a lot because this food is more, first, you know, it doesn't have hormones. It doesn't have it doesn't depend on processed food and grain. And at the same time, this food is very fresh and nutritious, so it will help in the health of the people as well.
Now, what happened to commodity crops, tobacco, sugar, coffee, and so on? Is there still export from Cuba?
The sugar business collapsed, and 75 sugar mills were closed down. And there is only right now, rather than massive exports of sugar, what we have is very, very good crystal class organic and fair trade sugar that is exported and for say sustainable. So the total surface of sugar cane that were like a big monocrop of the country was totally reduced. But we still export very, very big amounts of tobacco, gourmet coffee, some citrus, and some fruits as well. The priority switch from commodity agriculture towards dedicate more land to feed the Cubans and less money to import the food. Nevertheless, we still produce lots of rum as well and some other add-value crops on the distilleries and derivatives of the sugar. Honey is another big agricultural export of Cuba, especially to European Union. And some of the, like the fishing industry became very sustainable, as in the case of the conch and the lobster, and some sustainable use of exports of shrimp as well, because this will allow to continue in a sustainable way.
As Cuban agriculture has become almost completely, 80% organic, and people are eating more fruits and vegetables that are locally produced and so on, have you been able to measure any effects on the health of the population?
Yes. I call the agriculture in Cuba chemical-free, low input, low energy, low emissions, socially fair and local. Like, I don't know if organic, like, can encompass all of that, but I think that we work in the different dimensions. And yes, just imagine that just by practicing this kind of agriculture, you exercise a lot. So that makes you fit. You walk, you use your bicycle, you bend a lot. So these have like a very, just by doing it, you get like a very, very important training in your body that helps you to be healthy. Second is that this food is chemical-free and very, very fresh, really fresh, not like food chain fresh. So people will have that access to healthy food and fresh food. That's another thing. Third, there is a combination of the green medicine. That means the green medicine that you in your garden will grow medicine plants that, rather than taking, you know, complicated Western pills, which allows people to use the herbal medicine. And this is also helping to decontaminate and detoxify your body. And also, people are eating less, you know, of the food that is not that healthy for cultural reasons, you know, pork or deep fried things, and they're taking more salads and like that kind of light foods that we need in a hot climate. But the impacts on the health, they're very, very hard to be evaluated, because like since like the access to the health system is universal and free, the system always prevented that many, you know, obesity and problems like that outbursts in the country. I think that our Achilles heel will be like an excessive consumption of sugar that is a risk of diabetes type 2. That means that you need sugar. But it drastically, in my opinion, changed the diet of the Cubans. Still some Cuban craves for the old unhealthy food, but I think that this new form of nutrition arrives and it will stay for good.
Cuba is so isolated from the United States economically and to some extent culturally, but you've got relationships as a nation with so many other nations in Latin America and around the world. Are you working with them in terms of agriculture and permaculture and all the things we've been talking about?
Yes, it's a pity that the blockade and the differential of policies made very difficult the relationship between our two countries and our two people. But I have to say that one of the features of this new process that we have in the 90s was that the country was open, so we have good relationships with Europeans and Canadian companies, and of course South America, and Central America is become like more and more a part of the island Caribbean. And yes, you're right, like Cubans having training people on permaculture, on urban agriculture in many, many countries of the vicinity. I see that the main places have been Dominica, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, but there were some work in Colombia, some work in Brazil, some work in Nicaragua, and in other parts of the Caribbean as well as San Lucia and Dominican Republic, just to give you some examples.
Roberto Perez is a sustainability activist and permaculturalist from Havana, Cuba, and he will be giving a lecture tomorrow night titled Learning from the Most Sustainable Place on Earth. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, the 28th of August at 7 o'clock and he will be speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation here in Santa Fe, and it's a benefit for the 11th International Permaculture Convergence Scholarships. Roberto, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, thanks to you for this opportunity. And I have to say that the idea of Cuba as a sustainable country came from an analysis that WWF did about ecological footprints and human development index. Cuba happened to be there in that very unusual space to be considered sustainable. We know that sustainability is complex and it's like horizon. You have to walk towards there, but there always will be new challenges. And I think that we have a lot of things to do. I don't even know if we are the most sustainable place in Earth, but the idea is that we are walking on the right direction and, like, new challenges way ahead. And I think that if we want to be self-reliant, I mean, when we want to face the climate change challenges for the Caribbean, we really need to be working on the path of sustainability, and that's exactly what we're doing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.